Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been around since 1982, and there are archives that go back to 2006. As always, I like to remind people of a few things at the top of the technical net. If you have any questions that you would like to ask, but you do not have access to a radio and cannot transmit, or if you have any topics you would like to have covered, subjects, puzzles, we'd love to get puzzles, and we're going to bring them back real soon. And if you want to contact Paul and ask him about some article or website or video that you've seen, the email address to do that all is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Articles that I will allude to or that Paul might allude to or interesting articles. There was a particularly good one, a video that demonstrates how a N95 mask actually operates. All those and more will be available, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Page, you just type into the browser, roy.ac2gs.com. There's a chat room if you're so inclined. You just type in to a browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and you can go into the browser and discuss life and times with other people. As always, I am streaming this as best I can through the internet for people who do not have access to radio or IRLP or Echolink and other ways of getting it. So if you have friends who would like to listen in live, you can just have them type in technet.ac2gs.com on their browser and you'll get the audio stream. And as I mentioned before, there is archives of technical nets going back to September of 2006. Mike, KC2NJI, at amateurradio.tv offers archives going back down to 2006. So please take a look at his site and listen to a few of them. They're very informative. Let me drop for a second, and I'll be right back with the further adventures. A new addition to the technical net, I'm very pleased to tell you, is something we're going to call Andy's Corner. Andy, WA2CDL, is going to take some time off from his busy things that he has to do, and he's going to share with us an article that he's found in issues of QST and elsewhere, and he's going to tell us about the article, and that should be very informative. So we're going to do that starting tonight. I haven't quite decided when the best time will be. I guess I'll just kind of get a sense of the activity going on, and either the beginning, middle, or the end of the technical segment. We'll ask Andy to step in and do Andy's Corner. So that should be an interesting new addition to the TechNet. I really look forward to it. So once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net. And if you have any questions or topics or statements that you would like to share with the Technical Net, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Bravo Zulu, just listening.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're listening, Rich. I want to also wish everyone out there a happy Father's Day. I hope that you had a good day, everyone out there who's a father. So I hope it didn't dissuade you from tuning into the technical net tonight, but we shall soon see. So once again, if anyone has any questions or topics of a technical nature that they would like to offer up for the technical net tonight, please give us your first name and your call sign.
Roger, Roger, Roger. This is KC2QYW. Name here is Joe from Harrison, New York, and yes.
Okay, very good, Joe. We will put you on the list. Anyone else want to go on the list for questions or topics tonight on the Limark Technical Net?
And just to let you know that I am here, WATCDL, listening in.
Okay, very good, Andy. I told people to look forward to Andy's Corner soon, and we'll see where we can best put it during some portion of the first segment of this technical net. So I'm glad to have you aboard, Andy.
Okay, thanks. Should be fun, should be exciting, and informative. And that's what we like. Back to you.
Yes, indeed. That's what we like. So once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. If you have any questions or topics that you would like to have addressed tonight on the Technical Net, please give me your first name and your call sign.
82OGB, yes. Something on my computer, and I'm looking forward to Andy's stories, Roy.
Very good, Craig. Consider yourself on the list. Once again, anyone else out there wants to put their name on the list? I mean, we're not going to lock this thing down, but it's always nice to know how many people are in line. So if you have any questions or if you have any particular topics that you would like to either have addressed or address yourself, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, unfortunately that signal was almost all noise and dropout. So if you can either kick up the gain or wiggle the antenna in a slightly different position and you want to try again, that would be okay. Okay, nothing heard. That gentleman that couldn't quite reach the repeater, I hope that you're able to make some adjustments. We'll come back and we'll ask if anyone has any questions later on. We're not going to lock this down so early into the evening. And once again, if anyone else would like to put their name on the list, this would be a good opportunity to do it right now. Just give me your first name and your call sign.
W2 Tango Echo Charlie Chris, just listening.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Let's go to our first question for tonight. Joe, KC2 QYW, what's your question for tonight, Joe? Joe, KC2QYW, you just checked in about 4 minutes ago, so I'm assuming that you're somewhere close to the radio. Hope nothing serious is going on. So if you hear me, please hit that push to talk and tell me what your question is for tonight.
Roger, Roger. This is KC2QYW, Joe from Harrison, New York. Yeah, Roger that. Yeah, Dr. Roy, my question to you is, are they going to come out with some kind of coronavirus vaccine shot? And my second question is, is it safe to do that, to get the vaccine shots? Because I never do the flu shots. And I never get sick from the flu. So back to the net. Back to Dr. Roy.
Okay, Joe, it's actually a rather complicated question that warrants a complicated answer. At this point, there is no proven vaccination for coronavirus. Matter of fact, one of the stories that I kicked up to the front of the list, if I do any science talk stories, is going to have to do with the unfortunate studies that demonstrate that antibodies are not a given with this virus, perhaps. But getting back to your primary question, there are over 100 different forms of vaccines in some degree of being researched. In terms of research, you want to know two really important things. You want to know safety. The idea is not to kill people. Back in the old days of swine flu, you might remember, or you might have read it in a book, there was this thing called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which was a rather nasty thing that caused paralysis to one degree or another, and sometimes required people to put on respirators because they lost the ability to control their diaphragm. So you want safety, and if you approve it to be safety, you want it to be efficacious. You want it to be effective. You want it to be effective in a majority of people injected. A vaccine that gives immunity to only 50% of the people who get it is not a very good vaccine. So you want safety. You want efficacious response to a large percentage of the people that are given it, and you want a significantly long-term immunity. If it's effective for 100% of the people vaccinated, but it only gives you immunity for 2 months, that's not a great vaccine. So the first thing that we got to do is figure out if we have a vaccine that is both safe and efficacious. And from there, you could make an educated decision of whether or not you want to be one of the people who takes the vaccine and joins the group with the herd immunity, or you want to not opt out and hope that you don't get it and hope that the other people who got it will save you from needing it.
Amen. KD2OGB.
Yes, Greg.
A personal thought. There are tons of vaccines out there that are being looked over, and there are a few of them that are going through trials. And yes, what you're saying is true. The idea is not to kill, though, of course, there could be side effects from taking these vaccines, which is the reason why they're testing them. Being maybe a little sick or other side effects, I'll take versus dying from it. But, yeah, you got to take it one step at a time, go through the trials and tests, and then go from there, and then they can expand it with further testing, and then eventually get into mass production.
Yeah, Craig, I would agree. First, we have to find something that's worth the expense and time of reproducing billions of samples and getting it spread throughout the population of the world. You can't just vaccinate the United States, because unless you're going to kind of put up a wall around us, we're going to get exposed to it from other places. So you got to kind of make a couple of billion samples of the stuff. And you don't want people suddenly being paralyzed and requiring iron lungs. That's not a good vaccine. So I agree with you. We'll see what happens. I wish I had a crystal ball. All this talk about having millions of dosages of a perfect vaccine by the end of the year, I think, is incredible optimism. We'll be very lucky if we have a reasonable supply of something that's useful by sometime in the middle or the end of next year. This is going to be a long-haul battle, guys. I'm sorry to tell you this. I wish I could tell you it's going to fade away tomorrow, but I see no indication of that.
Yeah, roger that, roger that.
So, Joe, basically, did I answer your question, or do you have anything else to ask?
Yeah, Roger, buddy. Dr. Roy, thank you. You answered my question. And, yeah, of course, keep me updated, and I'll check this repeater next week again on Sunday. And, like I said, keep me updated, and we'll take it from there. And thank you for the answer, and everything you answered very, very good. Thank you very much, and back to net control. This is KC2QYW, Joe from Harrison, New York.
Okay, you're welcome, Joe. Anytime, you know where we are. Next on my list is Craig, KD2OGB. What's your question for tonight, Craig?
Okay. So, it actually has something to do with my computer, as a matter of fact. And I figure I'd bring this up here, and not just the computer net, since it's been a while since I've attended that. That would perhaps come on another time. So, I have 32 gigs in this, soon to be 64, and I recently used a program to try to dump the RAM a little bit. It's at 22%, and I only have one thing opened. It's got, like, 7 gigs, I guess, being used, but I wonder if there are other ways to free up some of it without having to use external programs or so. Like, what would probably be the main cause of taking up RAM? Because eventually it builds over time, even if you have nothing open.
Well, yeah, one thing you got to get used to, unfortunately, with Microsoft and Windows is it does not age well. Linux, you can run a Linux server for a month, and I have, and it works beautifully. If you try to do that with most Windows operating system computers and you run a bunch of programs, open and close them, start and quit them, you lose resources, and I describe it as the operating system gets constipated. It gets kind of sluggish, it slows its response, and what's happening is resources are being taken up and not correctly given back to the system. You know, different people have developed different habits of how long they'll run a computer before they'll reboot it. In the case of my big computer that I'm using right now, that I kind of gaze upon everything here, I usually reboot it about 2 or 3 times a week. But some people do it daily. Some people turn their radios. Some people turn their computers off at night and turn them on the next morning. I tend to leave mine on for the long haul. Let me drop for a second, then I'll continue. As far as memory, your different applications are taking up more page memory, some more than others. A big abuser sometimes are browsers. If you, like me, like to have a whole bunch of tabs open up on a web browser, there's a lot of memory caching that goes on for each page. You can sort of get around it by loading in an application that sort of puts the tabs to sleep if they're not in view and used, and so that'll bring back some of the resources. Or you might want to just limit the number of open tabs on a browser, or limit the browsers, or look into other programs that you generally run without thinking. There's usually a lot of things that start at the beginning of an operating cycle, and they're probably what's taking up all that page memory. I do not suggest that people buy memory compression programs. Way back when memory was rather expensive, there were products that supposedly did that, but there were all kinds of problems, and they tended to not be compatible with a lot of things, and so software solutions I would suggest against. But anything that does an analysis of the amount of memory that each application is taking up gives you an idea of where you might want to prune to limit your memory. You know, you take up something like Premiere, any Adobe product, and it could take up a massive quantity of your memory. You know, people have 62 gigabytes, and they can soak it up with just a couple of applications from Adobe.
Speaking of Adobe, I actually do use Adobe Premiere Pro to edit videos. The second about 3032. Now, if I export in HD, it jumps up to about 5253. On the older PC, it would be at almost 90. In 4K, it would be like 98, like near the red line, 99% almost. And my CPU and video card would like go beyond like 140, and they would just work so hard.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to understand that you're asking it to do a great deal of work. If you had a time machine and go back 10 years, you couldn't find a computer, a personal computer, that would be able to handle 4K video streams. It would just choke it entirely. So you have to kind of be appreciative of the amount of bit twiddling that's going on under the hood. And it's doing it in memory, which is much faster than if it was doing seeks in hard drive memory and doing read, write, read, write, read, write on a hard drive, or even on a solid state drive. Doing it in RAM is the most efficient time-saving method of manipulating those bits.
One program that I did use a couple of times to dump some of this memory, which I got to get the full version, but it's actually worked very well and it kind of helped a little bit, is System Mechanic, if you've ever heard of that program before.
Yeah, I've heard of System Mechanic, and usually it depends who you talk to. Some people like it, a lot of people don't. It's one of those things that sort of promises you performance that no one's really been able to prove. I think they still include a defragmenter, which doesn't make a great deal of sense these days because the operating system basically has a built-in defragmenter for hard drives, and you don't want to defragment solid-state drives because that just ages the solid-state drives prematurely and doesn't benefit you. So, although there are people who buy it, and there's a lot of advertising for it, I have never been a particular fan of it. I use CC Cleaner, which kind of does similar things with a little bit less of the razzmatazz. I stay away from registry optimizers because I have heard too many horror stories, and whenever you use those, you should back up your registry. But I've heard too many horror stories of the artificial intelligence algorithms trying to clean things in the registry and wreaking havoc on them. So, you know, I would caution you. If it works for you, then that's great. But I would caution you to be very cautious about the System Optimizer.
Bravo, Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
My daughter just showed up, so I'm actually going to have to go after this. But the jury's sort of in on optimizers, and as I don't know if you were just saying this, Roy, but as you know, some of the how things flip flop, especially like in medicine, you know how they're saying now that optimizers do more harm than good, and the benefit versus the harm of them isn't worth doing it at all. I'm sorry if that was said already.
No, it's perfectly fine, Rich. I like to have people who agree with me. And I even like to have people who disagree with me if they have good information about it. But, yeah, I stand with you. I would not use a registry optimizer at this time because of what I know and have had experience in the past. I use CC Cleaner purely to kind of clean out backup copies of Windows updates and temporary files that you would think that Microsoft would be able to delete by itself. And it does if you know the magic tricks, but it's just easier to use CC Cleaner. So as I pretty much said and Rich said, Craig, as far as getting rid of programs that are running too much, using too much memory, I would kind of do an analysis of what programs you're using that takes up a lot. There's no getting around places like Adobe. If you're going to do 4K resolution imaging, you're going to have to pay a price somehow. If you don't want to pay it in RAM, you're going to pay it in seek times of either the solid-state drive or the hard disk drive. So I would limit my browsers and limit the applications that take up a lot of memory and just know which ones are eating it up whole and don't run more than one of those type of programs at a time.
You've ever heard this, but with Android, and I don't know the technical reason for it, but with Android, takes advantage of a fuller memory. Have you heard that, and do you know why?
Well, I really don't know a great deal about Android. That's Google's operating system for mobiles and such. There was a time where Microsoft with Windows played all kinds of memory games. You could plug in a USB thumb drive and enable it as a kind of half-assed, if you will, a memory expansion. It caused probably, again, more problems than it solved. It slowed us down a lot of processes because USB is not the same as the direct connections that a bus line has or even the motherboard has. So I'm not quite sure how Android addresses extra memory, but I'm sure there's a hip. You know, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch, as the old saying goes.
Another thing that I did hear, you know, the system care tools, those all-in-one bundles, I've heard, and it's been my experience, that I can't really, I've never put a stopwatch on it, but I can't really tell that much of a difference for, you know, before or after, you know, cleaning up the MLLs and whatever memory dumps and caches are left over and all that. You know, I still use CC Cleaner on one or two things. I think it's more psychological than anything else. But with all said and done, I think if you put a stopwatch on before and after speeding, quote unquote, speeding up your computer, you'll find that not really worth it. Anyway, thanks, Roy. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu.
You're welcome, Rich. Well, although I do use a CC cleaner, I kind of use it as a cleaner. I use it to get rid of unnecessary files on my hard drive or solid state drive. So I'll be able to see, you know, if my drive is 45% full and I run it and it goes down to 42%, then it, as far as I'm concerned, it's done its job. I'm not expecting it to optimize my registry or speed up caches or do any fancy stuff. I just want to get rid of some junk that Microsoft left behind during an update. And by the way, I actually took the plunge and upgraded my three personal computers to 2004, the latest, greatest June update of Windows 10, and it didn't screw up one of my computers, which was very nice. I always back up my images before I do this, because once burnt, always wary, and three for three. So thumbs up on 2004. It seems to be a decent update. So back to you, Craig. Did that at least address your question?
80 GB, pretty much. The only other way around it, I guess, which would take up way too much money in the long run, is to completely replace the RAM with new RAM. And I would certainly not want to do that, but eventually I will go for 64. Another thing that I have Adobe set up for is that the video card does all of the rendering, and it takes more stress than the CPU, actually, when I export, and it runs a lot faster. Not only that, but on my battery tower here, it's running around 20%. When I export something or play a game, it actually jumps up to about 35%, and it goes up a bar, so yeah. This does take up a lot of resources. So I'm going to have to think this one over.
Okay, very good. And I think anyone who has a reasonably nice 3D accelerator graphics daughter board is aware that, you know, when they use it to read email and such, the fan is very quiet because it's the way it's designed. It doesn't pull a lot of power when it doesn't need to. It has a lot of cores, but it can turn them off. But when you turn on something that is very graphics heavy, a 3D game or a 3D program that utilizes the accelerator chips, it causes all the power to go up on the board, and then it needs the fans to go up in speed to dissipate the waste heat that's generated from that. So, you know, you basically, for the most part, these overpowered computers are kind of just getting by. You know, they're barely operating when you do things like email and most websites. It's when you want to render things in 4K and do all kinds of interesting 3D gaming at high resolutions with anti-aliasing, that you kind of call upon the core power of these chips. And that's when it sucks the power up and gets noisy, and you see a lot of power drain from your UPS.
I've more than likely told you this, but remember, I do a lot of multitasking. I work with 4 monitors. Right now I have YouTube in 1 monitor, and everything else is pretty much shut right now, other than my little cam here, program that I'm looking at for all of the readings of my stuff. And I actually have 6 hard drives in this machine. I have 8 cores, I have an MSI GTX 960, and 32 gigs. The video card is at 81 degrees Fahrenheit. For whatever reason, it's showing the CPU at 32, which I don't see why. It should be at like 71 or 75, and the load for the RAM is 22%.
Okay, very good. If you have nothing better to do any day, you can go to QRZ and look up my call sign. And I have a picture of Mission Control here on my shack. It has 3 monitors, but sometimes I use a writing tablet that is the 4th screen, and I have a nice little Lenovo X1 tablet on my left hand side and an iPad on my right. So if you have nothing better to do, check out QRZ. It might amuse you.
Question.
Yes, person with a question.
It's Ed, K2GJE. There are files that sites sometimes put on your computer so that next time you go to it, it's easier to open up. What is the name of those files, over?
Well, it sort of depends. Some companies get really tricky about that. I have a particular program for a remote control of a transceiver, and the guy is very nice, but he keeps hiding the encryption file in strange places, and when I clean stuff out, I sometimes clean out his file and have to ask him for a new password. Usually those are cookies. Very often you will have especially if you've disabled cookies on your web browser, you'll have a browser page pop up and says, say something along the ways of, by the way, we use cookies, and you're not letting us use them. Would you please let us use them? So I think what you're looking for are cookies.
Thank you. You answered the question. I sometimes manually wipe out cookies, but I forgot the name of it. Now I'll know where to look again. And I wipe out temporary files. But some of the temporary files, I don't know what they're for. I leave them in. Over. Thanks for your help.
You're welcome, Ed. Yeah, there are so many places where Microsoft hides bits and pieces of itself. I think at one point they decided that they were going to just put everything in the registry, and then they decided not to put everything in the registry. So, different programs work differently. Some of them store everything in the registry. Others have a .inf file. And, of course, web browsers live and die by cookies. I loathe cookies for a series of reasons. If I look at a product at one website, and then 2 or 3 days later I'm going to another completely different website and I see an ad for something that I already looked at, I get this sense of Big Brother is watching me. Maybe it's a nascent paranoia or something, I don't know. But so I try and disable the cookies. I realize that there's a utility to them. They make life a little bit easier. But, you make your decision of how much ease you want and how much privacy you want.
Thank you so much for your help. I've noticed that if I research something on Google, a day later I'm going to get an ad for that product, over.
And Katie through OGB.
Yeah, Craig, 1 second. We've all been there. We've all done it. I guess some people just take it in their stride,
I find it somewhat annoying. You know, my attitude is I looked for it, either I bought it, because they have no way of knowing whether you bought it. You could have bought it, and now they're still trying to sell it to you. So, I don't know. It just rubs me the wrong way. Craig, you wanted to say something.
Well, as far as cookies go, when it comes to YouTube, I'm very picky about it, and the problem is YouTube has changed with COPPA coming into play, and even though I'm way over 13, but unfortunately they've changed it how people accept cookies, because now they're using the information in the wrong way without parental consent, and that's why YouTube got hit by the FTC. But that's a whole different discussion, but I'm very picky about cookies sometimes because of that.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many decent plugins for the different browsers. I don't know if anyone has looked at Microsoft's new Edge browser, the new one, not the old one. The old one was a piece of garbage. The new one is basically a variation on Chrome. So it takes Chrome-like plugins, and I find it to be a acceptable browser. I have also used a Google Chrome, and I use Foxfire as well in times. They're all basically running on the same type of an engine, but I find plugins and enable programs that block bits and pieces of my private information being sent out. And I also invest in a virtual private network. So if I really want to hide behind the wall, I can do it.
COPPA also has it set up where if something is deemed for kids, it blocks the advertising, because that's part of how it collects cookies without parental consent. That's why COPPA was created.
Okay, I mean, like all things, the government is always about 10 or 20 years behind the times technologically. You know, most of the people writing our laws grew up, you know, you know, if you think amateur radio is kind of skewed towards the somewhat older people, you should check the Senate some days. So it takes them a little bit more time to get on the stick. And sometimes their first, second, or third attempt isn't quite good enough. So you got to give them some time to figure things out. But eventually, hopefully, they'll figure it out.
Yes, perhaps. Anyway, so yeah, I will consider thinking this over. But I do want to continue using System Mechanic, and it hasn't really affected me in any way so far. But when I had a couple of older components in the tower, this is something that I want to bring up, and then that should be it for then. As soon as I put the computer on and I log in, around 10 to 15 minutes later, everything completely freezes. No blue screen or anything, but everything just freezes. I can't hit Control-Alt-Delete, nothing. And so the only two ways out is to hit the soft reset button or hold the power button and to forcefully shut it down. Is that called a hard lock?
Well, yeah. You know, not that, you know, if you use a different term, people will smack you with it. That's a severe failure that doesn't... Failures, at worst, are supposed to land you at the blue screen and then do a core dump. And then you send the core dump to Microsoft, wait 15,000 years, and they fix it for you. Or more likely, they just send you a letter saying, we don't support that piece of hardware that's causing you the problem. Go throw it away and buy a new one. But yeah, that's when there's a terrible hardware conflict, and it doesn't even gracefully do a core dump. You know, sometimes that happens, especially if you use old pieces of hardware. Sometimes the drivers just do not work with each other well, and the companies don't update their old drivers for new operating systems. So it depends upon the utility and the cost of the old hardware. I have found
generally, it's best to just upgrade to something that the companies are actually rewriting the drivers as the operating system gets upgraded as well.
Two Bravo Zulu, I lied, I'm back. I just want to say that there's a program called What's Crashed, that Craig may look into.
Okay, Rich, that's a good suggestion, What's Crashed. I think, though, it requires that it tag the blue screen, at least, or some other, because otherwise there's no real place that it writes anything to. If it just locks up the system entirely to the point where you have to power off the computer and power it back on, I don't think there's any kind of way for it to have the opportunity to write a suicide note.
You know that for sure, I'll accept it, but just because the blue screen of death, you know, hasn't popped up, doesn't mean that it's not writing a file somewhere that this program can analyze. But if you know that there's nothing that's written so you can, you know, you can read it after a reboot, then I stand corrected. But I think there is, because just depending on the blue screen of death and the dump files that it's dumping, it would be a pretty limited piece of software. But anyway, this time I really have to go. Anyway, thanks, guys. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, back to net.
Okay, Rich, thank you for your input. It might be worth your trouble to look into. I've never used it. I don't know if it's free or if it costs something. It's not that difficult to be able to tell if stuff is being written to your hard drive in your computer, even if it locks up. If you look at the little indicator for the hard disk drive writing and you see it flashing off and on, it might be an indication that it's writing something. If the screen locks up and the HDD indicator stays at the same illumination, my guess would be that it just died.
Well, remember, it just doesn't go into a blue screen, it just hard locks, and so I have to forcefully shut it down and bring it back up. I've gotten a blue screen only a couple of times on an older tower, which I ripped out the hard drive, formatted it, and threw it in this one, and here's what would happen then. Sometimes it would blue screen right at startup, like right before it would show the login. And I think the message it would say is like a problem or thread of crucial something something. And then the other would happen after I log in. The mouse would freeze for a second. The whole screen would distort for a split second and then go out. And then it would say as the thing, system service exception. And it would blue screen for 2 seconds and then reboot itself.
Okay, well, I think theoretically what it's supposed to do is it's supposed to do a core dump of whatever data it has available so that you could send it off to Microsoft, perhaps, and then it tries to do a reboot. Now, sometimes it can't do that reboot. It locks up at the blue screen. And because one of the failures is the inability for it to reboot the computer, so you have to hit the power, hit the reset button, what have you. So, you know, different problems cause different types of blue screen. I have a Flex 6700 radio that has 8 different virtual audio channels. And for some odd reason, when it loads those virtual channels at startup, one out of, say, 5 times, it does it in an order that Windows does not like, and it puts up a page fault error and blue screens on me. So it's just something that I've learned to deal with. A company that makes the software and hardware keep promising to fix it eventually, and I'm not holding my breath.
The blue screens, it never even says beginning dump of physical memory. It just shows, I'm actually reading it right here in an image. It just says initializing disk for crash dump, and then 2 seconds later it just reboots on its own.
Okay, what probably is going on is it doesn't have any data to dump. So it's doing its predetermined, first it tells you, don't worry, I'm going to dump the core. And then it looks at the core, and either the core is too corrupted to do anything with, or the core doesn't really have any information, and it just skips that step without saying oops to you.
Probably makes sense. And eventually down the road, it just stopped hard locking, probably with updates, I guess, that came across or whatever. But it just was so annoying. And it never happened every time. It would happen like every fourth or fifth startup, I guess. I would log in, do whatever, and then it would just hard lock randomly, and then I just reboot. So it's not doing that anymore.
Well, that's certainly good. Sometimes drivers need to be upgraded. I have never turned down a driver upgrade request. Sometimes you need to update the BIOS. Some people are a little on the wary side to do that, but, you know, sometimes that helps, sometimes it doesn't. I find that these blue screens that sometimes happen and sometimes don't happen, it has to do, I think, with the variable nature of loading of drivers and the software related to drivers. There's no sequence that is constant. You can set up time delays for some operations, but a lot of it just kind of gets thrown in erratically, randomly, and, you know, if that particular driver installs itself before some other important driver, that can cause the crash. But, you know, only one time out of five times does lightning strike like that. So I'm glad to hear at least that the driver updates got you past that hardware problem.
Yeah, pretty much. There was one time on a very old laptop that I was just basically messing with, and I times and then just got bored. And ever since, the laptop is torn apart and the hard drive is wiped. I one time hit Control-Alt-Delete, went into Task Manager. There is a way to force a blue screen. If you go into Processes, I think it's CSSS.EX or something, and if you end it, it'll actually say, this will shut down the operating system immediately. The second you hit End Task, it blue screens and then resets.
Okay, I'm sure there's lots of interesting ways to crash the system. You can actually kill Explorer, and that's basically the GUI for Windows. And if you're lucky, it'll just reboot, and the taskbar will be repopulated. It's usually not repopulated with all the programs, unfortunately, because it's not that good at recovering, but there's a lot of fun little things that you can kill that probably most people shouldn't try to kill.
I'm actually looking for what it was in here somewhere. I think it was SCSS something, but yeah, that's what I ended in the services tab, actually, is what it is, and that's what basically forced it to blue screen.
Okay. Like I said, there's a lot of ways to break Windows, unfortunately. I'm endlessly amused. They stopped doing it for at least a year or two, but they used to keep promising to do away with the blue screen. You know, they would say, no, we fixed Windows. It's not going to blue screen again. And inevitably, about an hour after they make that announcement, some website shows you a screen grab of that build of Windows with a blue screen on it.
It's CSRSS.EXE. That's what it is.
So, okay. Did you remember what window that really opens up?
You have to hit Control-Alt-Delete and go into Task Manager to look for it. It's in the Processes tab. This was like with the very old laptop that I did this on. It was like Windows 7 or Vista, and I just basically kept screwing with it and just kept ending it and just crashing over and over. And then I just got bored and eventually got rid of the laptop and took the hard drive out. So, yeah, there's like many ways to trick the system into thinking that you ended something that's so important and it doesn't know what to do and it straight off crashes. So there you go.
Yes, indeed. Windows has never been called bulletproof. There's more than one way to crash it beyond belief. But, you know, it's very useful. It's not a perfect operating system. I know a lot of people who love Linux, and I wish them well, and people who love Apple OS X. And there's a lot of great things to be said about both of those operating systems. Windows tends to have the largest software base, to my knowledge. Again, not a perfect operating system. I loved my old Amiga OS back in the good old days when Amiga was an actual computer. But those days are gone, and you gotta dance with the one that brought you. So right now it's Microsoft Windows. Although I'm looking forward to utilizing the new 2004 build has a Linux kernel built into it in a virtual box, WSL2, that I'm looking forward to playing with.
My 2014 MacBook Pro actually is Linux compatible. I could just run boot camp in it. So, yeah, there's things I can do on that, too. This concludes my topic for tonight. Anything else, I will give you a shout. Net Control, KD2OGB.
Okay, very good, Craig. You know where to find us. Almost every computer can boot into Linux. PCs can boot into Linux. Apple can boot into Linux. OS X is basically a flavor of BSD Unix, which is Linux's older brother. So thanks for participating, Craig. And maybe this would be a fine time for Andy's Corner. What do you say, Andy?
All right, that's why we be. let me get set up here. Stand by. All right. All right, good evening to everyone listening. And I'm sure there's more people listening than checking in. I think Dick always used to say that. And that there are a lot of people listening on their scanners, so the information that I'm going to be giving from time to time will be informative, and hopefully they'll use some of the information, and that'll be good. So, for starting a new segment, at least I came up with this idea, because I do a lot of, little background, I do a lot of reading, especially the ham radio magazines like QST and CQ Magazine and all the others. And by the way, thank you, Roy, for presenting me. This should be a lot of fun. And I'm going to be doing this from time to time. Maybe not every week. It depends what articles I find that I would feel will be informative to the TechNet. And so we'll just play it by ear each week. So I found an interesting article since I've been thumbing through an old and new QST magazine. And I thought this one would be pretty interesting because people that do operate on the low bands or on any band and want to set up a SCED, mainly on the low bands, because even if you're operating in the digital mode and you're talking to somebody, because the internet is worldwide, and the problem with something being worldwide is that depending on where you are, will determine what time you're in, what time zone. If you hear fireworks, somebody's shooting fireworks outside my house. I don't even know why. So, in relation to time zones and relation to being on time when you want to set up a schedule, you know, let's say you're in New York and you want to talk to somebody in Paris, you can't say, I'll be on the air at 2:30. 2:30 p.m. in the afternoon, because the question is, what is 2:30 p.m. in Paris time as compared to New York time? So that poses a problem. So the powers that be, let me let it drop. I don't want to time out. Okay, I'm using the word the powers that be. at this particular point, but they came up with a thing called UTC, which really is Coordinated Universal Time. And what it actually is, and I'm going to read the article because it's interesting the way the article is presented, so you'll get a full understanding if I just read word by word, you know, rather than me just filling in the blanks. So I'll just read the article, and people will get an understanding of what UTC is. And by the way, UTC is it's a little bit confusing because it's pronounced as UTC, but it's really Coordinated Universal Time, which is CUT. And I'll get into that reason because they mentioned that in the article. So just before I continue with this, with the understanding of UTC, does anybody have any questions at this point? This is WHSTDO. Okay, all right, very good. So I don't. So for the general listening audience out there, Coordinated Universal Time is a universal 24-hour clock. And keep that in mind, 24 hours, because that's what it's what it's referenced to, 24 hours. 24-hour clock system based on the passage of time as measured by super-accurate atomic clocks. UTC is a timekeeping system used by governments, broadcasters, hams, scientists, and many others throughout the world. You will often hear it referred to as Zulu, Z-U-L-U. So the reason for the existence of UTC is simple. Stand by. Okay, the reason for the existence of UTC is simple, to avoid confusion. Imagine that you wanted to set up a meeting on the air with a ham in Paris, as I mentioned earlier. If he said, I will meet you at 14.2 megacycles at 3 p.m., you would have to translate 3 p.m. in Paris to your equivalent local time. If you are wrong, you'll both be listening to static, obviously. So the solution to this is for both of you to agree to reference one time system, which is known as UTC. So when your friend says that I will meet you at 1600 UTC, you'll know exactly what and when he means. So that obviously clears up the confusion going by UTC time. Any questions up to this point?
Comment.
Comment, go.
W2HL. Hi, Andy, and good evening to everybody on the net. I'm just wondering if the article mentions that, it was originally GMT because of the, and it was set forth because that area, the zero meridian, runs through. So I believe that had to do with the reason that they chose that area. Back to you.
Yes, I'm happy you mentioned that because that's the next paragraph. And the misconceptions between UTC, GMT, and UTI. Actually, it's not I, it's 1, UT1. It looks like an I, but it's a 1. So it's UT1. So, I'll read the next paragraph and then that'll clear that up. So it goes on to say, and again, I'm reading word for word because it's very well written. If you're like most hams, you probably keep a clock near your radio and you have it set to UTC. They do make, and you can buy these, I think MFJ even makes a 24-hour clock that's got the UTC time and it's got the local time and all the other times. And they actually do that automatically. There are computer clocks that do that. I think you could even buy a wristwatch. I think some of these smart wristwatches will do that automatically if you program it. So if you're an avid, HFer and have all these skeds, you can set that up. So, it actually says, some hams who wear dual time zone wristwatches always leave one of the two displays set to UTC. Either way, the UTC clock always remains the same. It never moves forward or backwards.